for our Corcoran Memorial Lecture. So I wanted to start by just giving an explanation of what the series of memorial lectures is. So this is this year's Corcoran Memorial Lecture. It's named in the memory of Stephen Corcoran, who was a graduate student in the Department of Statistics until his death in 1996. He had been an undergraduate at Oxford and got first class honors in mathematics in 1991. Then he went and studied for a diploma in mathematical statistics at Cambridge and returned to study for his DPhil in statistics at Oxford. Every other year we have a Corcoran Memorial Prize, but without fail annually we have a Corcoran Memorial Lecture. So this year is not a prize year, so we had free rein to choose the topic of our speaker. And so we asked Carrie Mengerson to come and speak to us today. So we're very pleased that she agreed to do so. She is a distinguished professor of statistics at Queensland University of Technology, which is in Brisbane, Australia. She's the deputy director of the Australian Research Council Center for Excellence in Mathematical Frontiers. She's a fellow of the Australian Academy of Science and the Australian Academy of Social Sciences. She's also a member of various national and international statistical societies. She has wide-ranging research interests in both mathematical statistics and its applications in areas including health, environment, and industry. And in particular, she focuses on Bayesian methods. So she has very kindly agreed to present to us today. And so we have this morning scheduled lecture because she is speaking to us from Australia in these COVID-restricted times. I'm just about to hand over to her. We will have a question and answer session at the end. So if you have questions, please type them into the chat and I will read them out to her, or a selection of them, because we probably won't be able to answer all of them at the end. And otherwise, thank you very much for joining us. And I will hand over to Carrie for the lecture.
Thank you very much, Crystal. And thank you very much for the invitation to present this lecture, and thank you to the people who have given up some morning time to attend. As you heard, I'm in Australia. It would be great to be there, but in fact, this is the way it is at the moment. So I'd like to just share my screen and I will talk to you. Okay. Can you see my screen?
Yes, that's great.
Okay, all right, thank you. Right, so I'd like to talk to you about not aggregating data. And I'm going to do this by first presenting a couple of case studies where the imperative for this area of work has come about. And then I'd like to talk about some of the work in progress in this area. So this is new work that we're doing, and if people are involved in this or have some suggestions or comments, then I'd be very excited to hear about them. It's certainly not complete at the moment. So the two case studies, the first one is the Australian Cancer Atlas. And the Australian Cancer Atlas is an interactive online atlas that brings together cancer data, GIS location details, digital earth technology, and statistical models to provide an online interactive map of cancer, about 20 cancers in Australia at the small area SA2 level. So there's about 2,000 odd of these areas across Australia. And this map is based, the underpinning technology or modelling in this atlas is a Bayesian statistical model. So we have here YI is the number of cancer cases in a small area, and EI is the expected number of cancer cases in that area, age and sex matched. This is a Poisson model, so we model our number of cancer cases as Poisson, and we have E to the mu I being the relative risk of that cancer in that particular area. So mu I then is modeled in terms of some potential covariates, xi, and also a spatial term, si. So this spatial term is going to incorporate the information of the neighbors in the area, given that we are in geographical space. So we have a number of options for that spatial term. For example, the Bisag-York-Mollier model proposed by Bisag et al. In 1974 has a term splits up that SI, the residual, into two parts. One is the spatial component UI, and one is an unstructured component EI. And the UIs then, the spatial components, depend on the neighbors, U tilde I. And so it's going to be normally distributed, that random effect is going to be normally distributed based on the average of the random effects in the neighborhood of UI. Now, an alternative to that is from LaRue in 2000 and LaRue's colleagues. And here we model SI as UI, and UI has two components. UI has it's almost like a mixture. So it has a component that has something to do with the spatial neighborhood, and also a component that is the overall variance. And this then allows us to have this mixture model that is governed by a parameter rho, which says how much weight we want to put on the neighborhood, the spatial neighborhood, and how much we want to regress towards the overall mean. And now this LaRue model then has only this one parameter rho, and turns out to be quite a good model for the kind of spatial analysis that we want to do in the Cancer Atlas. So the Cancer Atlas then, as I said, is this online model, and I'll just show you some of the features of it. You can pull down any of the cancers you like. You can get information from those cancers, in particular the visualizations about the probability of being above the national average or below the national average. And we're talking here about uncertainty in estimates, and we're also talking about probabilities. And so we're also able to compare areas and provide the information as well in the form of the modeled estimates at the small area level. So the Cancer Atlas we're going to extend this to space-time, and already it's shown quite a lot of information in terms of, for example, spatial inequalities. So this chart here shows the difference between major cities, regional and remote areas in terms of for females for different kinds of cancers. And you can see here some really startling differences in the standardized incidence rate on the left axis there. This is all compared to the national average, which is one. Some stark differences for people in remote areas. You can also get from this information, and we've been able to provide relative survival curves and relative survival estimates for each small area level. And we can then look at localized and advanced relative survival curves and the differences between the different areas, so remote areas and cities. And you can see here that there is this kind of real difference that this atlas has been able to reveal. And we can ask questions like, how many premature deaths could be prevented if there were no spatial inequalities? And so by being able to quantify these terms, then this has really led then to a real media release, a real public acknowledgement of differences, spatial differences in cancer across our country. It's also led then to a change in government policy in terms of the travel subsidy for people in the bush to get treatment in the city. So we think this is successful. And what's interesting for us is that this is a product that has underpinning it a spatial statistical model, a Bayesian model. Now, we've also been looking at just more recently spatial Bayesian empirical likelihood, so we can avoid some of the parametric assumptions in our modeling. And so the model here looks the same as before, but what we're going to do instead of assuming a normal distribution for the log relative risk, we're going to have estimating equations and use these estimating equations to be able to derive our parameter estimates. So we have the typical estimating equations. Here, we're going to have the constraints on the mean and the variance. And then we also have priors on this, and we can obtain the estimates. So the new part here is including this spatial random effect in these empirical likelihood models. And the kinds of priors that we can have for our random effects are, for example, an independent Gaussian prior. Excuse the spelling of Gaussian. We have conditional order regressive priors like BYM and LaRue as before. We also have, for example, the generalized Moran basis prior that has been used in previous work on spatial empirical likelihood in the paper of Porter et al. So there's not a lot of work on spatial empirical likelihood, and this was a contribution to that effort. The simulation results, when we look at the empirical likelihood approach compared with the parametric approach, you can see here in a simulation study where we have high order correlation, low order correlation, and also outliers. And we have that for a small number of areas and also a larger number of areas. It turns out, as we might expect, that the empirical likelihood approach really shows its colors when either we have a small number of areas, and so the normality assumptions may not hold, or we have these outliers. So when we have this 20% of outliers, then our Bayesian empirical likelihood approaches seem to outperform the parametric approaches. So this has promise for our atlas. Now that's fine in terms of being able to model, but one of our concerns still in this is the issue that we needed to aggregate the data. Now Australia is based on a number of states. Each of those states holds the data, and we needed to have agreements with each of the states in order to be able to bring those data together and then to create the models. Now this has to happen regularly. And if we want to change anything or obtain new data, we need to go through those agreements again. There are very real issues of privacy, and there are also issues of obtaining permission for these data. So the methods that we have at the moment don't address those issues. They certainly address the privacy issue in terms of providing the information at the small area level, but we still need to aggregate the data into one database. Our second case study here is the Virtual Reef Diver project. So the Great Barrier Reef is one of the world's treasures. It's 2,300 kilometers long, and there is monitoring at certain sites along the reef, but there is a lot of area where there's no monitoring. So what can we do in those areas in order to be able to help us to develop accurate and useful predictive models across the whole of the reef? Well, there's underwater drones, there's satellite imagery, and there's numbers of divers who are out there collecting information. So we built an online interactive reef, so it's called Virtual Reef Diver. We are inviting organisations and citizens to contribute or geotag their photos, their images of the reef. And we are also asking citizens to go into the images and annotate them. So if any of you are interested in contributing to the health of the Great Barrier Reef, please visit virtualreef.org.au. Now, what we have then are these images. You can download the images of the underwater images of the reef, and then also classify them. So we ask citizens to annotate the circles here as to whether these are coral, algae, sand, and so on. And we can use that information then to improve our statistical models. There's a huge impact of this work. This project was selected as one of the shortlisted for the Eureka Prize in Australia here last year, which was very exciting to us. So we have citizen scientists who can annotate the images, and we can use those annotations in their own right, but we can also use them for automated image classification, so machine learning and statistical methods. And you can see there the list of kinds of statistical methods that we've looked at for classifying images in the environmental space, but then also in the medical space. Now, the last of these is matrix factorization, and I'd like to just concentrate on that for a moment. So in particular, we've been looking at kernelized sparse Bayesian matrix factorization. So the aim here is to extract low rank or sparse structures. So for example, our classes in our image, and we're going to use matrix factorization techniques to do it. So we have data, which is a Y, an M by N matrix, so like an image. And this can be the values at each of the pixels in the image. And we want to recover then the low rank matrix X, where we have Y equals X plus E. And this X is going to be then decomposed into two vectors, U and V. And these vectors, U and V, are going to be much smaller than the original matrix X. So U is, if we have X being M by N, then we have V, for example, being N by R, and we have, sorry, U being N by R, and V being N by R as well. And so when we put these together, the R here is much smaller than M or N. And then this induces sparsity into this, this low rank approach. Now, we also can use our priors to induce sparsity. So we have Gaussian priors for the columns of U and V, as you can see here. And one of the features of this approach is that we have the same parameter gamma J, which is going to appear in both the variance for U and V. This then, we can control that gamma J to induce the sparsity. So we have the prior on the gamma has a gamma distribution, and the hyperparameters of that prior distribution are going to be small. And this is the way that we can really induce the sparsity in U and V. We couple U with a kernel matrix K, and that gives us a latent matrix G. And this G then has a prior, as you can see here. Now, we also then have Jeffrey's priors on the other parameters here. So we also can do the same kind of a prior for V as well. So just to complete the model, we then have a residual term and we have a prior on beta as well. But we're focusing really on that U and V here. And so just to show you a graphical model of what we're doing here, we have Y. Y is going to now be governed by G.M and H.N. And G.M is going to be a combination of KU and UM, and H.N is KV and VN. And then these are the hyperparameters on those as well. So these, we're going to induce the sparsity through these priors. We have conditional and joint distribution. So we have a conditional distribution for our observational model, which is going to have this G and the H there, and terms, and we have then a joint distribution, which is of course is going to be the product of each of these individual distributions. And we can use variational Bayes then to undertake the analysis here. Now the choice of kernel here, there's many different kinds of kernels, and so for images we want that one that incorporates some similarity of information between patches. And so what we want to be able to try to do is to have patch group matrix factorization. And so we want areas that are similar to be in the same, to stay together effectively. So what we do then is we look at this distance, a Euclidean distance between a pair of patches. This is the D. And we're going to define a similarity between that the pair of patches as in terms of that distance D. So we have K, as you can see here, being a function of that Euclidean distance between the pair of patches. So we're going to have a pixel, and its nearest neighbors then are going to be modeled as a column vector. And we then can construct this M by N patch group matrix Y by grouping the other patches with similar local spatial structures in the underlying one in the local window. So we're bringing together the common information in what we call a patch. And since each of these patches then are common, then we can induce this low rank sparsity that we wish. So the overall algorithm then is to cluster patches with similar spatial structure to form a patch matrix. And then we can apply our matrix factorization approach in succession on each of these patch matrices. And then we can aggregate the patches to reconstruct the whole image. So this is one approach to being able to deal with a large image in order to be able to understand the low rank structures in that image. So when we look at Virtual Reef Diver, for example, we might want image restoration, we might want classification of components like coral and so on in the image. And you can see here the utility of this function. We have an original image, we've made noise in that image, and then we can retain or resurrect that image using this method. So the method then allows for integration of site information through the patches. It infers parameters and latent variables, including the reduced rank using variational Bayesian inference. And we get this low rank through sparsity induced by an enforced constraint on those latent factor matrices. And we can show that this improves on some of the state-of-art approaches for image restoration tasks. So that's great, except we still have the issue of not wanting to aggregate the data. In this case, we have two issues. One is that these images are quite large, and so if we're going to create a single database to analyze the images, that's going to become very unwieldy very quickly. Even analyzing a single image is difficult because, and we've already seen how we break it into patches, and then we need to do the analysis on the patches. The second aspect is that we have citizens contributing information. Now, again, because of the provenance and the data laws, the data ownership laws in the UK, in Europe, and in the US and coming into Australia, we're going to be really restricted soon about how we can actually deal with individual people's data. So we want to think about ways that we can avoid creating one database to rule them all. So what are our options if we look at this? Well, our single database says that we put all the data in a single database and then we do the analysis on that. We can also look at distributed computing. So here we can, if we have a number of databases and we then can have a centralized computer, a centralized source that then distributes the commands to the different databases and then receives the information back. So this kind of distributed computing is very useful. We have horizontal scalability, which means that we can then add more databases or more nodes to this, this distributed system. And then we can obtain more or greater capacity by doing so. Of course, that comes at a cost because now we have computational interchange and those computational that overhead may be quite large in some cases. So there is sort of there's a utility in having a vertical scalability, in other words, a larger database. And then after a point, we get to more utility by having this horizontal scalability. And there's a huge amount of work on distributed computing. You know, there's whole areas in computer science and in statistical areas that are focused on distributed computing. We know that we have a greater fault tolerance in this case. If one node falls over, we have the other nodes. There's low latency in this. And we can also use methods like sharding and so on. And I'll show an example of that in a minute. This distributed computing system has motivated approaches like MapReduce, PatchyStark, Hadoop, and so on. So this is our two of the approaches. Another one is decentralized computing. Whereas our distributed computing had a central node that then governed the information going out and back, decentralized computing doesn't do that. So it says the information is processed in the cloud and there is no one actor that owns that information. This has led then to new work on distributed apps and also has led to edge computing. And so for many of you that you will be familiar with this, but I'll just explain it quickly. Edge computing is that we don't process the information on the cloud filtered through these remote data centers, but instead we do the analysis in the cloud on the individual nodes, and then they are aggregated as needed. So this has then led to areas, for example, like federated learning and federated analysis. And so there are lots of advantages in this because this is very much the system that we're in with these, or the area that we would like to get into with the two case studies that I showed. So in the first one, we have the Australian Cancer Atlas, where we actually have these different states that would like to retain their data, and we would like to be able to analyze the data in situ and then bring it together. We would also like to be able to, in the Virtual Reef Diver case, be able to analyze the images in a more decentralized manner. And also when we come to integrating personal information, then we would like to be able to come up with systems where we can retain the provenance and the individual privacy of citizens, for example, and subjects in a more broad sense. So if we go back to our Australian Cancer Atlas, if we look at a single database and we ask the question of how do we retain privacy when we have the data at this small area level? Well, one option is that we actually analyze it at that small area level, and then we're in the business of a single database. And so we've been looking at, for example, summary data analysis that we might do on the perform or undertake on the actual modeled estimates at the small area level. So a natural way that we might think about this then is through a hierarchical meta-analysis where we have our modeled log SIRs for each of the SA2s, the small area levels, and we might be interested in remoteness, cities, regional and remote areas, and then we have an associated standard deviation for that log SIR that's actually part of the information that's provided from the underlying Bayesian spatial model that I described before. So we can set up then a hierarchical meta-analysis in the way that we have Y then, the YI for a particular within the regions of the cities, the regions and regional and remote areas. That's normally distributed with a mu. We imagine that there's some measurement error or some uncertainty around the YI that's described by the sigma squared IJ. Our mu IJ then is going to this is then the true SIRs or log SIRs for a particular region, remoteness region, and they're going to have an overall value of theta J. And those theta J's then for each of the remote areas, if we wish, can also be considered to be draws from an overall log SIR, which is going to be described by theta naught. So we have our individual estimates of the log SIRs for each of the remoteness areas. They are drawn from an overall mean log SIR, a distribution of log SIRs for that particular remoteness area. And then the means of those areas then, the remoteness regions, come from some overall log SIR that then governs the distribution of log SIRs that governs then the whole structure. The sigma squared IJs then can be related to our observed standard deviations SIJ through the usual chi-squared association. We can also add covariates to this, as you can see in the middle panel here. And this is sort of a common approach for analyzing or to add covariates. And we can then look at some new work, which is when we look at our spatial Bayesian empirical likelihood approach in a meta-analysis context. And that's on the right panel there. So this is fine for one approach that we might use for modeling the summary data. And so we overcome privacy issues here. And we could then also, areas could be more encouraged or different states could be more encouraged to provide information at this small area level. And we could perform analysis like this. We can show that if we do this, then we get quite similar results in these overall estimates for remoteness regions like major cities, regional and remote. We get here posterior means 95% credible intervals and the probability that one region is greater than another region, sort of the natural outputs from our Bayesian models. We also can see then if we go to the individual SA2s and we look at those estimates, that we are getting differences between when we analyze the data at the individual level versus when we analyze it at the SA2 level or this aggregate level, as anticipated. And we can also see that our empirical likelihood approach is going to give us quite a larger interval or spread of the data compared to our parametric approach, as anticipated, because these data are quite moderate and don't have those kind of outliers as we were talking about before. So our centralized summary analysis has some benefits and some drawbacks. The benefits are that we can preserve privacy because we have this aggregate approach. It's a simple model, it's computationally straightforward and fast, but there's challenging inferential capability because we're modeling at the small area level and therefore we have to be careful of controlling for biases in this case. We also have some questions about what can we say about covariates. For example, is the spatial distribution of our response consistent with the spatial distribution or patterns of our covariates? And we have to be careful then what kinds of inferences we can draw. And those inferences will change as we change the scale of the data. So we're still yet to scale this to different states and countries in a hierarchical, but you could imagine then how this would go to, we add a hierarchy to those models that we've already described. We come now to distributed computing. And so in distributed computing, then we're starting to think about how we don't have to create this single database. And I've just put this slide up because this was a BERS workshop in Canada. I wasn't at this workshop, unfortunately, but I just wanted to show you here some of the topics that were covered even in 2008. And this was about developments in statistical theory and methods based on distributed computing. As I said, this is a huge area in computer science, but it's also there's a substantial amount of work in the statistical community as well. You can see here approaches or focus on statistical methods with computational efficiency, with statistical properties, with guarantees about the estimators. These things are really important for these kinds of approaches. The divide and conquer algorithms that really underpin a lot of the work in this area, and rates of convergence for our estimators here. Mathematical theory for deep convolutional neural networks and distributed learning, a lot of work on distributed neural networks. And as said, divide and conquer methods, for example, for correlated data and spatial kriging, which is of interest for us in our spatial analyses. And so you can see here that there are these kinds of issues in the distributed computing that really focus on the statistical underpinnings of these particular methods. And again, just pointing out that one of the main approaches here is the approach that we're many of us are very aware, familiar with, the divide and conquer algorithms. So just as an example of some of this work, we have distributed Bayesian inference, for example, Wang and Dunson and Naswanger in this 2015 work, where really we're looking at decomposing the global posterior. So we take the global posterior distribution and we're going to break it up into a product of subsampled posteriors. And so that's the second equation that you can see there, which is going to just be conditional on the ZJs instead of all of the data Z. So that we have this prior then that's raised to the power 1 on K, and we have this DJ, which is a normalizing constant. But really what we're doing here is we've got these subsamples. We construct the posterior distributions from those subsamples. We bring those together and we weight them according to the, so there's sort of like this weighted combination or the weighted combination of the likelihoods. So this approach then really motivates the MapReduce approach. So we run separate Markov chains in parallel on different machines based on the local data. We transmit this back to these local posterior draws to a central node, and then we combine those draws to form an approximation or a surrogate likelihood that approximates our true global likelihood. So this kind of approach, as I said, it's been is familiar to us. There's been a huge amount of work over the last 10 years in this area. So if we come back to the virtual reef diver approach, we think about how this kind of approach might work in our case. An example I'd like to just talk through with you is where we were looking at crowdsourcing Biomechanical Turk. So we wanted lots of citizens now to classify our images. And so we used Amazon Mechanical Turk to recruit people. So this is an online system where people often pay, but people will undertake tasks. And so here we had, we asked them to classify our images. Each person was assigned up to 40 images. They were asked to classify points and we paid them for this. We got thousands of people who classified these images. And of course, then we needed to do something with the data. So and one of the issues is, of course, that we need to take into account that the ability of the citizens who are analyzing these data. And we have to take into account when we're looking at their ability, the difficulty of the images that we ask them to annotate. So if we think about this, then a RASH model is a common sort of model to use in this case. So this is the item response model, and a three parameter logistic RASH model is useful for us. So we expanded this model to say, all right, we'll use the three parameter logistic model, we'll add spatially dependent item difficulties into this model, and then we'll also expand it. Can you hear me?
Ah, yes, you're back.
Hello.
Did I get you? You left us for a little while and it's no longer screen sharing.
Right, okay.
Great, thank you.
Right, did I get to this? Right. Thank you. All right. So we want to be able to analyze the data from the citizens, and so we can use this three parameter logistic RASH model that has a spatial term in here, and the spatial term is going to be based on the images, and say images in a particular area are going to be similar in terms of their difficulty. And this kind of model then allows us to identify the latent ability of each of the users, adjust for the difficulty of the images, also allow for a discrimination parameter. So that's how quickly we change in the probabilities, and also account for guessing or pseudo guessing in this case. And so what we want to do here is we want to be able to identify the abilities of each of the citizens and adjust for that. So what we can do if we do that, I'll just show you here, is that we can say, we can estimate the ability, and this plot here shows that we do quite well in that. So we have some test data, we can assess their ability in a small sample of the cases. We looked at their estimated ability, and we can pretty much get that right from this approach. So this means then that we can only take the people who are doing a good job, who have high ability in this. We can also identify training or personalize the training for our citizens. So the options here, when we have all of this information, is again a divide and recombine approach. And so we divide it into, if we were to use a common divide and recombine approach, we'd split into multiple shards or subsets. We'd fit the model to independent subsets on independent machines, and we'd combine those posterior estimates into a global estimate using some sort of consensus Monte Carlo. And we'd have weighted averages of the posterior MCMC chains. That's as I described. So then an alternative is to divide the users into 10 equal groups with respect to the number of classifications that they did. This works very well in our case, because what we end up with is about 10 shards with about 500,000 classifications per shard. And so then we fit the shards in parallel, and then we combine that using some stratified sampling approaches. And we found this kind of alternative to the usual divide and recombine works really well here. So the benefits and drawbacks of this distributed computing approach is that we have efficient computing. We avoid repetition of these tasks because we have this distributed setup. We have a wealth of tools to do this now. We have privacy preservation in some sense, because we have the distributed analysis, and we can also increase inferential power by combining the data sets. We do have, on the other hand, though, potential for data leaks. We have possible biased and variable inferences if we use just the naive approaches. It's usually limited to point estimates. It's more difficult to get uncertainty estimates, although that's changing. And we still have some issues about degeneracy, and we have to be careful of that degeneracy of the weights that we have on the partial likelihoods or the local likelihoods. And there's a lot of work on avoiding or addressing those issues. So I'd like to come now to the approach that we're investigating currently, which is around federated learning. So now this is the next step out. So this is really decentralized approach where we want to analyze the data without the data leaving the source. So this can then help us to avoid the ethical, legal, political, administrative, and computational barriers to combining data from multiple sources. It increases control for the owners of the data. There is a potential to improve data quality and timeliness, because the data will be managed by the data owners. And we also have then increased inferential capability by bringing together small or dispersed data sets. So the way that the federated analysis works is that we have groups, we have the parties, the manager, and the communication computational framework. We have then the components. So we want to partition our data, we have a model, we have a privacy mechanism, and the communication architecture, how we're going to get all these actors to talk to each other. And then we also have the modeling approaches. And this is where we can really play a role here and combine with the computer scientists and the information technology people in making this federated approach. So our modeling approaches range from deep neural networks, boosted decision trees, regression, support vector machines, and so on. You'll see the image of the federated analysis. And below that, I have a figure also of the type of data sets that we might have. So we might have data that are split or partitioned horizontally. So each of the nodes, the local data, local nodes, has all of the data. So the Y's and the X's that are required for the analysis. It's just that they have subsets of that whole data set. The other option is that we have data that's split vertically. So one node holds one of the X's, another node holds another X, another one holds the Y. And then we want to bring all of these data together. So there's different ways that the data might be partitioned. Now, there's a lot of approaches for federated analysis, but this is really sort of just in the last few years. So there's some commentaries that are useful to get an overview of this. There's an idea of having a repository with data sharing agreements. These repositories are very common now, and there's a whole lot of work on developing these. But the question is then about doing the analysis once we have these repositories. We also have Bayesian networks as a way of being able to include data from different areas. And this is used, for example, in this example for survival prediction. There's neural networks, so a lot of work on neural networks, and then sequential and hierarchical Bayesian models for, now we're starting to get into the correlated data for time series data and also for spatial data. And there's also some work on, very nice work on communication efficient approaches. I'll just talk about those briefly in a minute. So we have for the federated sharing of genomic data sets, we have genomic data sets in this case is an example of this, this federated sharing of, in a registry sense here. So this is really going to be controlled. Each group controls its own data. They can dynamically add or drop instances from the group, and they can make agreements about the group. So there's quite a lot of sort of federated or autonomous autonomy in the way that these groups might engage with the overall registry. This example is from Mike Jordan and colleagues. Was work started around 2015-16 when the archive paper appeared, and then was published in 2018, and there's been extensions of the work since. But basically here, the way that this works is, again, a surrogate likelihood approach. So we start off by initializing theta naught, and then we're going to transmit that value to local machines, the current iterate to the local machines. We're going to now create the local gradient of the likelihood at each of the machines, and we're going to transmit that at machine MJ, we're going to transmit that to machine M1. We're going to calculate then a global gradient on machine M1. We're going to form then the surrogate function there, and then we're going to one of two things. We either update the thetas directly, or we're going to then have some sort of, one step quadratic approximation to get our new values of thetas. Then we will do the whole thing. We'll transmit those out again. We'll update the gradients. We'll bring those gradients back in. We'll combine the gradients, compute the likelihood, and so on. So it's a very computationally efficient way of using these surrogate likelihoods through the gradient. So there's Bayesian approaches of this, so I won't go through it, but it's really a similar sort of thing where now we're not going to be transmitting the posterior draws anymore, which is computationally intensive. We're going to be transmitting these gradients. And then we can show then for a logistic regression of images, in this paper by Jordan et al, that we can see from the plot here that that this approach is really gives us a much better classification rate compared to the usual approach. I'm going to skip this example other than to say this is a spatial modeling approach, which is very useful. And one of the few approaches that actually takes into account this strongly correlated data, the spatial approach that we have here. How am I going for time, Crystal?
If you could finish relatively soon, then we'll have time for enough questions because we've got a few in the chat.
Okay, sure. So coming back to our Atlas of Cancer then, we can combine cancer data sets across each state and countries. That's what we would like to do. And so we partnered with a group called the Netherlands Cancer Agency. And so they've been doing some excellent work. About this time last year, I was in the Netherlands to talk to them about this, and they've done some excellent work in the meantime, a collaboration called EuroCare. So this is open source federated analysis, which really demonstrates that this can be done, so achieved. And so if any of you are interested in this, I would recommend checking this site out. There's a site, Vantage 6, which is open source privacy preserving federated learning infrastructure. And they've got some great examples of combining data from the Netherlands and Taiwan, combining data from different agencies, and then combining data from the Netherlands and Italy. And so different kinds of federated approaches. So there's the federated approach, and you can see on the right of the screen, an approach where it just talks about how these individual nodes work. So if people are interested. So you can have a federated generalized linear model approach where you can calculate the MLE for beta via Fisher scoring. So what you do is you calculate the individual terms at each of the nodes. You then aggregate them to the global node. You get a beta out of that, and then the beta goes back to the individual nodes and so on. So we can get then the original version of EuroCare was where you had each of the individual countries. They all provided information to a single source, and then you got your estimates. The federated version is that the data stay where they are, then this approach works as I described before. So you get these individual values, and then you get your estimates, and you show that the estimates are relatively the same. So for Virtual Reef Diver, then, we've done a similar thing with federated analysis here with federated matrix factorization. So we've taken our matrix factorization approach that I showed before, and we've included an adaptive learning rate, and we've used stochastic gradient descent as an approach here. And so we've effectively decomposed the stochastic gradient descent approach so that we can use it in this federated approach. So what we get is a dynamic method. It's privacy protection. It has learning efficiency, significantly reduces the training time and maintains high predictive accuracy in this. So I won't go through the details of this, but you're welcome to talk to me afterwards or see from the slides. We do show that it has some strong advantages in this federated approach. So in summary, then, our data are changing. We have size, privacy, provenance, quality, diversity issues. Federated analysis and federated learning offer some solutions, but we do need statistical methods and combining it with their implementation. We've talked about two case studies and then looked at a number of approaches. As I said, this is work in progress, and I'd be very happy for any comments and suggestions. And I'll hand it back to you, Crystal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we can't give you the round of applause, but for the people who see, thank you very much indeed. So we have some questions already in the chat. And so one of them was about what assumptions you've made when you're analyzing cancer data about the surveillance. So what are you getting a fixed proportion of cases, or do they vary across areas? And then there was a bit of a follow-up from the same thing, is how do you account for different data collection methods in the different data sets that you're bringing together?
In the cancer data, we're fortunate in that these are a census, basically. So the cancer is a notifiable disease, and we have registries. Now, the registries aren't perfect, but they're very good. And so we take these data as given. You're right, though, in terms of bringing together data sets in this federated approach for that may be of different quality and also different representation. So those kinds of issues, as statisticians, we have some good ways of being able to deal with data that we have sampling approaches, or we have some sort of uncertainty that we might associate with different kinds of issues around sampling. And so we can bring those to bear on this federated approach. And I think it's really important for us as statisticians to be part of this, this move to these sorts of more decentralized analysis approaches.
And so also relating to federated learning and how things are moving, would you be able to do model checking or model learning in this context? How does that affect these approaches?
Yeah, I think this is a good case, the same as just the whole model uncertainty in the distributed computing case. And so there's people at Oxford who have been working in this area a lot. In some ways, I think the federated approach actually might help us to understand more about model robustness. So if you think about this, then we can actually think about like what are these surrogate likelihoods or when we create this surrogate likelihood about the local likelihoods. And perhaps we can learn more about how robust our model is if taking into account the assumptions about the different nodes. But then what are our likelihoods telling us? It's almost like we have replicates of the experiment, if you want, depending on whether we have the vertical or the horizontal partitioning. But we do have an opportunity, I think, to learn more about our models, perhaps, in this situation, or in this setup.
Okay, and then more of a political context question, which is, what would achieving spatial equality mean in the context of a cancer atlas? So in other words, is that the worst performing areas being raised to the level of the better performing areas?
So that's what you would hope, is that that you would have, and that's why we were looking at, for example, how many deaths might we avoid, or other kinds of measures like that, how much morbidity would we avoid if we were able to resolve that spatial inequality. So typically, even in a hospital situation, you might say what we would like to do is to get to the 80% mark. So we would like everybody to be at least at that 80% mark. It's one of those I look forward to the day when everybody earns above the average wage, but that's pretty much what we're trying to aim for here.
Okay, and then there was a more technical question, which was about a specific parameter. What is the impact of the choice of K sub U? For instance, why is this taken to the power of a fourth?
Yes, so the power of the fourth was because of the distance metric that we used. And I'm happy to go through the details or talk about that. That distance metric then was the way that we created these shards, and then the K sub U was actually being developed on each of the shards. So the parameter that was really inducing the sparsity of those vectors was really the gamma that was in both the U and the V the variances for both the U and the V terms.
Thanks. And then I had a question about the people that you've got sort of evaluating your images. And so when you're recruiting non-experts to do that, is it possible to somehow, if you have only a limited number for each person, it probably doesn't matter so much. But if you were going forward with people over a longer time, is it possible to provide feedback to help improve the performance of individuals? I suppose you could smooth everybody in the same direction, which wouldn't necessarily help, but I just wondered whether or not you can have a sort of feedback to improve the performance.
Yes, definitely. So there's a couple of things. One is there's a learning parameter in that equation that we have, the 3+ model. And people will learn as they go along as well. But if we cannot certainly have feedback. In fact, what we're doing at the moment is creating an R to VR package so people can actually then use within R, create virtual reality and then annotate. So have AIs like artificial intelligence so we can have questions and reminders and training actually appear in the virtual reality world. It's pretty exciting at the moment, but that's a talk for another time.
Okay. Okay. So one of the bits of feedback we got was what an inspiring talk this has been to finish the week with, which is perhaps a bit premature for many of our weeks, given that it depends on where you are, how close you are to the end of your week. But it's been great to hear from you. And it's really interesting to have such specific examples that are both important and also very different. So we can see how it's being used in a number of contexts. And that I think really helps us envision, you know, the wide range of other opportunities where this can be brought together. We're also in a particular context within the UK of just having gone through Brexit. And so that does change some of our data sharing relationships with other countries. And so it will be important for us to think about, you know, these federated approaches and how this might be used to avoid running into complications with data sharing and where different data sets are stored, that we can still get the benefits of all the data that are out there without having to put them all in the same place.
Yeah, that's true. I think it'll be, it's a challenge that all of us are going to need to face in our work. So great. We can certainly learn from each other.
Well, thank you very much again for spending part of your evening with us.
thank you very much for the opportunity. It's a great honor to be able to speak and especially for such a great cause and a great memory. It's fantastic that you remember people in this way, and I'm proud and pleased to be part of it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And we still owe you a dinner. So at some point in the future, you don't have to speak again if you're in the Oxford area. We'll be happy to thank you in a more traditional manner.
Okay. Thanks very much, Crystal. And thank you very much, everybody, for attending today.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed. Bye-bye.
Bye.